All right, so we're on our fourth and final lesson. This one's Science and Answers. I want to say from the get-go, this is not really a survey, because if it was a survey, I would just be, here's a question, here's the answer, la-da-da. Here's the next question and answer, and you wouldn't be able to explain the answers. It would be ridiculous. And if you went into detail on all the different answers, yeah, that wouldn't happen in one class period. That would be a year or two's worth of courses there. The approach I've actually taken is I've purposely made what I'm going to do in terms of slide presentation shorter. I'm just going to bring up a few quick points, and then I'm going to make it more of a discussion-oriented thing, so that if anyone has any particular questions, hopefully I or someone else we'll know the answers or be able to supply more information or something. Simply because I can't predict, you know, what areas necessarily need more addressing. So it's a little looser format. First, we'll actually deal with a few questions. This one is apparently quite a common one. Where did Cain get his wife? It refers to Genesis 4, verses 13 through 17, where we find out that Cain has a wife and goes off to the land of Nod and all that type of stuff. And people's point is, okay, there's Adam, there's Eve, there's Cain and Abel, and it's like, where did he get his wife from? And the quick answer is, he married a close relative, probably a sister, and we'll look into this a little more. This wasn't forbidden until the days of Moses in Leviticus chapters 18 and 20. And secondly, in Genesis, we have several examples of close marriage. In Genesis 20, verses 11 through 12, we find out that Abraham's married to his half-sister. In Genesis 43 through 48, we have Isaac and a cousin of his brought together by a prayer, actually. And then in Genesis 29, 13 through 28, we have Jacob and cousins. So we have several examples of close marriage without the apparent inbreeding that's normally associated with that. And in Genesis, the reason this could be possible is that in Genesis 5, 4 through 5, we find out that Adam had unnamed sons and daughters. So it wasn't just Cain, Abel, and then later Seth. There were several sons and daughters, apparently. Plus, he didn't die until he was 930 years old. What this implies is that Adam was genetically superior to us. Here we have the true millennials. The idea is, obviously, when God first created, everything was perfect. Sin entered the world and started corrupting things, but it didn't happen all at once. The mutations didn't kick in all at once and all that. So we didn't have to worry about inbreeding until round about the time of Moses. Now if you marry a close relative, you're just asking for trouble in terms of inbreeding and all that type of stuff. But back then, it wasn't a problem. And you'll notice, actually, the ages decrease as time goes on. Next topic I want to look briefly at is natural selection, which, you know, and maybe most of us are here kind of familiar with all this. Natural selection doesn't equal evolution. Natural selection is a selection of an existing option by natural factors. To be evolution, a new option must arrive, be selected, and then the selected must produce another option that gets selected and so on until we go from single-cell life to something complex like us. In fact, it wasn't Darwin who came up with the concept of natural selection. I don't know if he was the one that named it that, but he didn't come up with it. That honor belongs to a scientist and creationist named Edward Blyth. And this is actually something the Institution for Creation Research brought up. Clearly, he didn't have a problem with natural selection since he came up with it. In fact, what he actually saw it as a means of not changing the species, but preserving the species. Any aberrations or all that stuff would, by natural selection, die because usually they are defective. Which brings us to how evolutionists try to come up with those more options. If natural selection has to pick an existing option, you have to come up with a way to have more options. So evolutionists, many of them turn to mutations. The idea is that mutations supply a new option, it gets selected, and so on. There are several problems with this. Let's look at some. Mutations are generally bad. That's why most are selected against. There's sickle cell anemia. There's this galactosemia. No, I don't know what most of these are. PKU, Tay-Sachs disease, hemophilia A. Cancer is a mutation. You'll notice that most of these we try to avoid. It's a simple fact of life. Down syndrome, several others. Another problem is mutations have never been shown to gain new genetic information. They have either been mere rearrangements or loss of data. You know, the famous flightless bird on the Galapagos Islands. It lost the ability to fly, and evolutionists pointed out, hey, that's evolution. Well, it's certainly changed, but doesn't explain how the bird could have flown in the first place. Becomes a simpler object instead of a more complex one. Since natural selection favors surviving, and our DNA tries to prevent mutations, it has several safeguards to try to prevent mutations, then that suggests that mutations are a threat to our survival. I mean, yeah? Do you have something? Okay. Creationists, on the other hand, believe that mutations are a factor for genetic variety, the main source is God pre-programming us with that genetic variety. In other words, Adam and Eve would not have been virtual clones, but they would have had each had genetic potential, the other didn't. In future generations, this could be expressed through different combinations or subtractions, which would allow non-dominant features to surface. For instance, blue eyes is a non-dominant genetic feature. So if you have a brown eye genes, you're not going to your eyes won't express the blue eyes. And that was actually all I had in terms of slides. Like I said, I didn't want to go too much into as much into the presentation part of it. I was wanting this to be more of a discussion thing. Like particular questions about creation issues, or even something from a previous lesson. Like topics. Hopefully someone has curiosity, because we've got about 30 minutes to kill here.
Who asked the question, who you said people, or the question, who was Cain's, or where did Cain get his wife? That was a common question. It's not a question I'm familiar with.
It's not necessarily one that you and I've never run into it either, but apparently creationists who give these speeches and all that type of stuff who go around, they run into it a lot more. Its origins actually trace back to the Scopes trial, where, the pro-evolution lawyer, got the pro-O basically convince him to actually go on the stand, which was a foolish move for him to agree with, on the promise that the next day he would go on the stand. A promise which then the evolutionists broke. But what happened was the Christian, you know, lawyer kept fielding these questions and basically losing. He didn't have an explanation for where Cain got his wife. He was willing to accept long ages. He didn't have answers to a lot of questions that we have today, and so the credibility of creation's account took quite a blow, even though ultimately the evolutionists lost the court case. In the public opinion arena, long haul, the evolutionists ultimately won. And so that was one of the questions that the lawyer wasn't able to answer. And so, no, I don't know if necessarily everybody necessarily thinks of this question. I don't think that many people are biblically literate enough to even know who Cain was. Someone who's a little more aggressive and looking for arguments, this is one they might pick up on. Yes?
I gather from what you were saying about mutations that evolutionists are in favor of mutations. I'm not familiar with that argument.
I wouldn't say, I would say, like, in many things, when you start accepting one error, you wind up having to be a little schizophrenic in your thinking. I don't think any evolutionist would support inbreeding because of the clear effects, even though that would cause more mutations. I don't think, to me, would argue that cancer is a good thing.
So you're saying mutations, though, would lead to some improved...
I'm not thinking that. I don't think any of them would claim that all mutations are good. But the idea is that they think mutations would supply, by random chance, new programming that could then be selected and all that. But the odds against that are enormous on several fronts. I've got a little list here of some creationist resources, and one of them is a book called Not by Chance, where this mathematician, you know, just went through the various things and just calculated, did the math, and showed how mutations just don't fit the bill at all. They are overwhelmingly negative. When they're not negative, they're usually neutral. In the few cases where they are positive, which are extremely rare, it's usually under select circumstances, select environments, and then if you thrust them suddenly in a different environment, they wouldn't have any adaptation. They would have less adaptation. The other problem is a lot of mutations don't necessarily even pass on to the next generation. They have to hit certain parts of the genome that we pass on. It's not enough for a mutation, for example, to say it happened in your hand, because that has nothing to do with passing on your DNA to the next generation. So the positive change has to be in the right area. It has to, so that can be passed down. It has to provide enough advantage to actually be selected. And the thing is, these changes are generally so small that even if it provided a slight percentage advantage in survival, natural selection may not even really kick in, be all that effective in selecting it, because it provides such a minuscule advantage, if there were ever a positive one. Yes?
Given that, just a couple of questions about natural selection. One is that since the advantageous mutations seem to be so few and far between, have you done any reading about how the an evolutionary geologist, for instance, explains an explosion of animal remains in the geological record. They even admit that there seems to be an astronomical jump in the number of different species.
Yeah.
And if they only happen very few and far between, is there any explanation that they give for that huge jump?
For the most part, they try to ignore it as much as possible. If a fossil is out of place in geological sequence based on evolutionary preconceptions, it generally gets ignored. They ignore the fact that they're drawing conclusions based on a very fragmentary record. They have, in essence, a very strong emotional commitment to believing what they believe, and this in turn, like we do. The trick is that not all of them are admitting it. One of the responses has been punctuated equilibrium. The theory that, okay, we have all these, we don't really have the transitions, so instead there's these settled periods of time and then suddenly these vast mutations that dramatically change things as an explanation for the gaps in the fossil record. It's like there is no evidence because it just changed too fast. In a blink of the eye in terms of evolutionary terms. Other evolutionists point out that's biologically impractical. Personally, I think it's biologically impractical even at a slow level, but especially at that fast level. Creationists, of course, agree with both. The fossil evidence is not there, and that the punctuated equilibrium is not a biologically effective.
There is an argument from evolutionists that the organisms now are not susceptible to beneficial mutations, but back then, back in the day, they were.
Yeah, and there's actually this rather famous interview with Richard Dawkins where he was asked, can you think of any modern examples of mutations adding genetic information? And there's this, in the video he's thinking all that stuff, there's this nice long pause, and then he basically says that it's basically what he came up with as a thing. It's like which basically meant no, there aren't.
But
it is concerning because you would think if you were convicted of evolution, you'd have that on the forefront of your mind. Here's an example of a mutation adding information. Here's an example of a mutation adding information. And I remember watching Beakey, the intelligent design guy. He came out with a paper that was critiquing this one example that they had of this disease that was going around, I guess, in Africa or something. Details are vague, don't quote me. I think it had to do with the sickle cell.
Yes, it was a sickle cell anemia,
yeah.
And supposedly it can give some immunity to malaria.
Yeah. Well, do you remember what he said about that?
Well, I didn't hear his thing.
What was interesting was what they found was the reason the disease didn't stick wasn't because of a positive mutation that added information, but a discoupling. A breaking of the genetic code that virus was depending on. So basically they demutated, you could say. They lost information. So that made the virus no longer effective. So it wasn't that breaking caused different problems.
Yeah.
So it was arguable that it was better for them that it happened, but at the same time they still suffered from it nonetheless. And it wasn't an example of Darwinian evolution moving forward to the next era.
Yeah,
that was a really strong example for the evolutionists that got down pretty hard.
Yeah, and the fact that they have to pick a disease as one of their examples shows how desperate their you know, situation is.
Well, they're picking out the immunity that the people gain over the disease, but the immunity came because
a genetic.
The disease relied upon.
Yeah.
So are evolutionists arguing that evolution isn't something that's ongoing? So I always thought that that was something that they were. I don't know if they're saying that we're not susceptible to the addition of to genetic information anymore. Does that mean they think that evolution has come to an end and that we are the peak?
Some would probably argue that. Some would argue that we still have are still evolving. What you have to realize is that, similar to Christians, evolutionists are not all one category. We just talked about the punctuated equilibrium versus the more long gone out evolution. They fall into several different categories. They are united only in the sense that they are united against us, but not exactly what ground they stand on. For instance, how did life arise in the first place? And there are several different theories as to that, and you'll find evolutionists, bickering about which one. So we could literally use the arguments of one evolutionist arguing against this position, and that one arguing against that position, and so on, to build our case that none of these are viable. They're not a homogeneous lot. There's quite a bit of variety.
The religion of evolution has many denominations.
Yeah. Yes.
I didn't brush up on this, but you probably read some things about some of the famous examples of transitions, like the giraffe getting a longer neck, and the
right.
Any comments on that kind of classic?
The classic example, and you'll find evolutionists themselves reject this. They only reject bad data once they've come up with a new story. How the history goes. So, like those man ape to man transitions, they only drop them once they can find someone else to cling to. But the classic example was the idea this guy had that horses, a horse-like creature reaching up, for the leaves and all that stuff, gradually generation by generation would get a longer neck. Something that we know, in terms of DNA, it doesn't happen. If you work out and build up your muscles, that doesn't mean that your kid is necessarily going to be born very strong. He has to work out too. So he can't necessarily build on that. Or if you lose your arm, it doesn't mean your kid's going to be born without one. Most deaf couples have hearing children. They only pass it on if the deafness was caused by a genetic, it had a genetic source to it. And so, so that concept, became thoroughly discredited, and so there's Darwinism, then there's neo-Darwinism, and they just keep reinventing the wheel. Part of the trick with evolution is that it is such a plastic, if you can even call it a theory, that it can be that they're constantly adapting it, changing the story, trying to rewrite it.
To be generous, there is a scientific side to that where
you have to theory, you have to adjust things.
That and you adjust it. You have a theory. You adjust it.
The theory of we've gone quite a ways in our theory of Adam the atom from Aristotle to our current day, and constantly adjust it. But yeah, it's like it keeps on changing. Even, you know, various large concepts. It's a and it's not just the whole. We mentioned about the religious nature of this. There's actually another emotional dimension that I think is part of the pill. A scientist, by his very nature, is an explorer. The concept of these millions of years of another worlds, literally on our planet type thing, over eons, has, for some of them, this romantic idea. It's similar to, there used to be considered an acceptable scientific concept that the Earth was actually hollow and that there were other worlds down under there, which was the source of Jules Verne's Journey to the Center of the Earth, that concept. A concept that was, that's so popular that it still keeps on popping up in cartoons and movies. So that they had this idea of exploring Mars, assumed that there was this Martian civilization. It wasn't that the evidence was all that solid, it was that, there was a certain romanticism. This idea of new thing to explore, new worlds, that's part of the appeal of science fiction. Star Trek, you go around, you meet all these alien cultures. So that spirit of exploration, I think there's a certain appeal to that, emotional appeal to that, beyond just being anti-creationist.
Any comments about flood geology as an area to look into as to the fossil record?
Right. We were talking a little bit about, the various gaps in breaks in fossil records. For flood geology, where the idea is that things get buried quickly, it would make sense that sometimes you would see animals in one layer, and then there would be several layers, and then boom, it pops up again. For an evolutionist, this doesn't make a lot of sense. It's like, okay, how did it get fossilized here, and then all these millions of years later, finally gets fossilized again? Why the gap? And then no apparent change. Another problem with evolutionary approach to fossilization is the idea that it's supposed to happen over a long period of time. Well, we have these impressions of fish scales. We have footprints in soft mud. We have to deal with the fact that decomposition happens actually quite rapidly, even in poor oxygen environment. A rapid burial that begins the fossilization process much sooner makes more sense. Also, it's a mistake to assume that it necessarily is completely stone. A fossil could be an impression. A fossil can be partly mineralized, not necessarily all the way through. It can be completely mineralized. And then, of course, there's a problems with the rock layers themselves. Fossils can sometimes actually be partway between layers, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense to evolution, and you would expect the top to have rotted off or something. But of course, if the layers just keep on being added quickly. Another problem is that the rock layers can sometimes bend several layers, having these bent curves to them. Well, in the fossil model, that in the flood model, that makes sense. If, you know, these layers were added and then they suddenly, by, you know, the geological forces at the time bent while they were still soft and then solidified, then these curved layers make sense. But for an evolutionist perspective, if they were bent like that, they should have, you know, if they were added slowly over time, then they should have been dried and they should have fractured rather than, you know, bent as if they were pliable. And then the evolutionists have to account for, you know, all the legends of dragons. Several tales of dragons that go all over the globe, from the Aborigines in Australia to Europe. They have to deal with, you know, various drawings in caves that seem to depict, like in South America, where there's this drawing of a cave with these tribal men apparently hunting what looks like a one of the long-necked dinosaurs. It's something evolutionists, you know, have to deal with, is the fact that there are all these living fossils, you know, fossils labeled, you know, animals labeled extinct only to be found, and to be relatively unchanged. And so they have all kinds of fun trying to figure out the family tree. It's like, okay, the physical form, you know, we can put it together this way, but the DNA says something else, and then they have animals with the same features, but they don't think they're related, so they call it convergent evolution, where they supposedly came up with the same trait independently, and then when they are supposedly related but are different, that's where they diverge. And so it becomes this complex, it's kind of comparable to what happened when people thought the Earth was the center of the solar system. At first that seemed to be the simplest model, but then they started realizing that star patterns didn't have that thing. Pastor, you know, mentioned this. And so they started coming up with all these little gear mechanisms and all that type of stuff to explain it, and it just became more and more complex and more untenable. But there's an attachment to it. Aristotle, during revival of some type of science, Western science, was and that was going into a more modern form, was, you know, revered, and as were the other Greeks, and ironically to the point where they actually slowed down science. And so it's like trying to hold on by creating more and more complex mechanisms, when sometimes the simpler solutions are actually the more correct ones.
So, Henry, there's an example of a small mammal in a valley that different individuals get separated by distance.
Mm-hmm.
So the ones at the north end of the valley would look quite different from the ones at the south end of the valley, and they would even not be able to interbreed. And so that it looked like, and there's a gradation all the way around the valley, so that you end up, as you go around the valley from north to south, you end up with different appearing species of this small mammal. But, you know, they can all interbreed except the ones at the far ends. And so the explanation is that they're just separated by a long distance. And so the thought is, well, since they can't interbreed, then they're different species. but they're still the same. They're still the same genus.
Yeah.
So they haven't gone from being a mouse to being something else. But there is that sort of variation that you see in within a kind of mammal.
Yeah.
So some people might argue that this is an example of evolution. But I think that within the proper way of thinking of it is not that it's an example of evolution, but that it's an example of variation within the genome. Another thing that you might see is that you have, like the Galapagos Islands, you have different species of birds, and they vary by their appearance, and they can't interbreed, but they sure look a lot alike in terms of the rest of the body.
Yeah.
They haven't gone from being, that same genus. They're still finches, for example.
Yeah, and that's one of the problems is that people point to these things and say, this is evolution in action. The reason you don't see it going from one species to another is because our time scale is too short. But then they don't account for things like some of those finches on Galapagos. You put them in a slightly different environment, and within a few short generations, all of a sudden, their beaks start changing to match the conditions. And it's like, that's not genetic mutation, that's the inbuilt variety that God gave it.
Adaptation in the environment.
Right, it's like... evolutionists have confiscated natural selection and adaptation, but it's like, that's...
So I have a question for you, Henry. Are there other... you talked about how Adam lived 930 years, and therefore he was genetically more superior to later human beings. Would there be some other other reasons why he would be able to live so long besides
genetic superiority?
Not having all the mutations.
There would be several. Partly the mutations not only would affect how long you can live in terms of natural age, but not having the mutations would also mean overall health in terms of physical vigor and mental ability. We were probably talking about some muscular Einsteins back then. But also, it's generally believed that the pre-flood world may have been a much less hostile environment. And that when the flood happened, it produced vast amounts of change that made things much harder. In fact, creationist explanation for dinosaur extinction is that, most of them were wiped out during the flood, obviously, and the samples from the ark, while they would live and all that stuff, may not have been able to adjust necessarily to the new conditions, especially if humans were going around killing some of them.
Smoking. That's what killed the dinosaurs. That's one of my favorite parts. I don't really understand biology. I don't understand genomes. I don't understand evolution. I'm really a dumb bear. But it does seem to me that one of the problems that evolutionists have that they haven't been able to answer is having an account of the soul. And that doesn't appear to be a trivial problem in my mind. That somehow the material world produced an immaterial soul, or in the span of
recorded history shows that people have been thinking a lot about their souls. And my guess is that their endeavor to explain the existence of a soul, in as much as they believe that there is one, is just nothing more than chemical reactions. Is there a somewhat coherent account of how man came to possess a soul?
I think for the most part they don't even address the topic at all. It's left as a vague thing. It was addressed. I bought just last Friday The Physics of Star Trek, and then when he was talking about the transporter, he said, one of the issues you have to address is the possible existence of the soul. Because if you're beaming from one location to another, are you just making a copy of yourself, and then what happens with the soul? And for the most part, he didn't really, conclusively deal with the soul really at all, even though he was himself the one that introduced the topic. He didn't really seem to think it existed. Although he wasn't going to emphatically say that it didn't. And he seemed willing to accept some, that there may be some other explanation for the soul, but it's not something that he concretely dealt with. It's something he left kind of up in the air, as something that you would have to consider if you actually built a transporter. The ethics of that, and so a few other ethical questions he pointed out. But ultimately, I think part of the reason why he didn't feel the need to pursue it all the way is because he basically concluded the transporter was impossible. So he was, that got him off that kind of hook.
Part of it would be because stuff like that would just fall under religion and be just labeled as a coping mechanism for dealing with our problems. Something we give ourselves to give us hope in this life. It's not actually anything real. It's just something we've made up to make ourselves feel good at night.
Well, even outside of religious influences, just the existence of the soul. There's plenty of historical non-Christian and non-Jewish history of thinking about the soul. It's been an important part of recorded history.
To play Dawkins' advocate, though, we're very capable of abstract thought, and we can definitely ponder things that don't exist. So the widespread thought on something doesn't make it so. And so I think an evolutionist would say, how do we know that a soul actually exists? Without pointing to your Bible, how can we say that a soul does exist?
I had a friend once who stepped on a bug, and when asked why, he said that bug was so dumb he didn't even know he was alive. There's just a categorical difference. And it strikes me as one of the things that if you can't see that man has a soul, that some things are patently self-evident. It's the witness that God puts in someone, whether I point to the scriptures or not. God puts that revelation in people, and it's a presupposition of theirs to assume that all that is knowable is something that we can deduce through genetics and chemistry.
I think, though, that there is, based on some of my conversations, that there is a tendency to suppress even that, because I'm not seeing in the class what the difference between man and human, the difference between man and animals, and how do we communicate, why do we think like this, and animals obviously don't, and one of the responses I got was, what if we can't tell that they're communicating? Like, basically saying we don't know that the animals don't have a soul, basically, is what it sounded like, and it was kind of shocking.
Well, there was actually a science fiction book, Island of the Blue Dolphins, where basically the idea was that this guy was actually learning the language of the dolphins, and that they had an oral history and all that stuff, and called themselves the people of the sea and things like that. And while they were considered not as intelligent as us, they were thinking of them as sentient. So, yeah. It's a... So, do I think that the knowledge is put into them? Yes, but it can be unsuppressed. It can be suppressed in unrighteousness. And even if they, you know, it's like, and how would they define the soul and spirit? They would probably, I mean, so yeah, it's a lot of conundrums that they have to come. Oh, and it's actually 10:34, so I guess we should wrap this up. One of the elders could lead in prayer.
Oh, Lord God, thank you for the blessing of the minds that you have given to us. You have set us in a world that is beautiful and complex. And I'm glad that we are given the ability to explore and to seek to understand and to order the world that you've made. Lord, I pray that we would do so with a view towards you as the creator. And help us, Lord, in our interactions with others, that we might be able to point to the fact that the heavens themselves declare your glory. In Jesus' name, amen.